Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larson, Judge Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is December 14, 2023. This panel of the court is gathered together here in courtroom 200. We have six cases on our agenda for today, four of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument based solely on the briefs. 1 minute, please. All right, and now we are ready to call the first case. The first case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A22-1718, Hortensia Salceda Abad versus Jason Matthew Matasovsky. As counsel are aware, each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Rhea Bornman Spears, and I am here on behalf of appellant Jason Matasovsky, also present this morning. The best summary I can put before you is that the order under appeal does not accurately reflect the trial that happened or the trial that could have happened. As the court likely noticed, based on the timeline of our trial dates, COVID interrupted this trial and it was spread over many months. And it seems as if the court may have written the order long before my client's case was presented. You will notice that there is an omission of all of the witnesses my client called, and of course the wrongful exclusion of the expert witness whose testimony and reports had outcome-changing value. A big part of the trial order's exclusion is the 11th factor from the best interest factors under Chapter 518.17, and I want to make sure that I get it on the record early on that in this case, with as long as it drug on, my client lost more than 18 months with his children because of the 11th factor. Mother's credibility should have been discussed based on her repeated efforts throughout this long time frame that this case was open, beginning with an order for protection in 2016. And there should have been discussions about the criminal charges she tried to get against my client, the 9 child protection reports. All of that should have been under the 11th factor.
Am I correct that the 11th factor is, I think, your third argument? Am I correct that that argument depends on your second argument, which is challenging the finding of domestic abuse?
Yes and no. So, yes, you are correct that it is our third argument that because the court decided that there was domestic abuse, they thought they didn't have to go into that factor, but we don't agree that the court didn't have to go into that factor because, and also one of the cases we relied on, Thornton v. Bosquez, even in that case, the court, it's a Supreme Court case from 2019, and the court found domestic abuse in that case, but they still went into the 11th factor in that case. And that's another, I think, strong bit of evidence to show the court why that factor matters, because of course the court also had to consider whether the rebuttable presumption regarding legal custody was still an issue or whether that was resolved. So, of course, we rely heavily on Thornton v. Bosquez because in that case, that individual who was found, actually, Mr. Thornton was the husband, he was actually found to be a victim of domestic abuse by the mother. And in that situation, the court determined he had exerted coercive control and manipulation of the mother even though he was the victim of the domestic abuse, but that that still did not rise to the statutory definition of domestic abuse. And so, of course, the court talked about his behavior in that case, and it's far more egregious than any of the behavior that my client was accused of, even if you do buy in, or even, you know, even with the worst findings of the district court, without, of course, taking into the fact that they didn't question mother's credibility, which, of course, we believe would have been more of a topic if the 11th factor had been discussed, reviewed, analyzed, and on top of all of that, if our expert witness had been allowed to testify. It's no secret that he would have talked about the fact that if mother lied all of these times, all of this extensive pattern of lying on her part, all of these attempted manipulations to get my client to have consequences, some of which resulted in successful interruptions of his parenting time, that leads the court to make a conclusion that her credibility should be in question. And if she was lying for all those months, all those times about abuse of the children, and even retracted that in the process of this trial because it strategically became a disadvantage for her to continue arguing that he had abused the children when so many professionals had said he hadn't, suddenly she shifts gears right before trial. And the judge said it was all water under the bridge to my client and thought that he should move on from the fact that she had made all those allegations. And of course, her order reflects that that's how she felt as well. But those allegations matter for considering whether she was credible in the domestic abuse allegations. And that's not weighed either. But luckily for this court, you don't even have to go that far because the court can't expand the definition of domestic abuse to include her opinion that coercive control by my client was domestic abuse.
Didn't the district court make findings of conduct by your client that were physical in nature?
No, Your Honor. So there was one incident that was witnessed by different people, and there are descriptions of events such as, I mean, the worst that you may be thinking of is at one point, grandmother, who also lived in the home, who, by the way, never said my client domestically abused his daughter, saw father on top of mother, which dad acknowledged was when he thought she was having a mental health crisis. She was on the ground. He was trying to get her up. It was chaos. He'd never seen this kind of behavior before. He described walking down the stairs with her with his arms around her so as to not touch her and violate her space, but to make sure she wasn't going to throw herself over the stairway, because that's how bizarre her behavior was and how concerned he was that she was actually a danger to herself at that time. And then there were neighbors that observed the situation who testified. One neighbor, of course, modified her testimony between the time she called 911 and the time she actually testified to where she reported a mental health crisis, or said it sounds like a mental health crisis by the woman, and that the husband or the man is speaking calmly to her. And then the neighbor who saw the situation even, you know, tried to intervene and be of help at the time, and my client complied with all of his direction. My client, you know, described the situation as being at a loss of how to handle it based on how she was acting. But nobody saw any kind of physical harm. Allegedly, mother had injuries on her body, which supposedly grandmother saw. But again, mother didn't reveal that to a third party of the police. There were no pictures. There was no evidence. And this is something that, again, you know, isn't, it's not tied in with the case. Go ahead.
Would you agree that there was an order for protection in December of 2016?
There was, and my client agreed to that with no findings. And so that does not mean that he was found to have committed domestic abuse. He agreed to it, as he explains to me, under the advice of counsel at the time. Of course, counsel he did not continue with, but that counsel advised him this was a good strategy to just get things to calm down and then you'll see your kids soon. Well, instead, you know, a guardian was appointed, or I shouldn't say instead, it was sort of true because a guardian was appointed, and then that guardian immediately recommended he resume parenting time based on all the positive interactions she saw. But he continued to extend that order for protection because his counsel told him he needed to keep that guardian on the case. But unfortunately, that wasn't exactly true because he could have gotten a guardian through the family case, which of course he did, Ms. Motzko, as soon as it went into that.
Then the standard of review is abuse of discretion, correct?
I believe, yes. I'm not sure for which topic, Your Honor.
Well, as far as the domestic abuse.
Okay, yes.
Okay. So where there's an order for protection and there is other evidence of perhaps verbal, they call it verbal coercion, I think. How is that wrong?
I can explain to you. So a couple of things. For one, the Thornton and Bosquez case is really helpful on this because it talks about that individual saying, you know, extremely vulgar, degrading names and insults, none of which my client is accused of, by the way. And that still did not rise to the statutory definition of domestic abuse. And the court acknowledges in their order that there was no finding of domestic abuse through the order for protection. The custody evaluator didn't make a determination of domestic abuse. The guardian didn't make a determination of domestic abuse. So the only person who actually came to the conclusion of, quote, domestic abuse was our referee, who, as I mentioned, expanded the definition of domestic abuse, or tried to at least, by including coercive control. But again, Thornton v. Bosquez says she can't do that because coercive control. And also, Thornton v. Bosquez described how that coercive control affected the other parent, described it as causing a power disproportionate arrangement, right, because Bosquez lived in the home, or mother lived in the home of the father in that case. Mother was less educated, et cetera, and wasn't able to make decisions as freely as she would have been. And so ultimately, the court gave that mother sole legal custody. In this case, we have no findings of how coercive control that supposedly happened during this relationship had any negative impacts on the mother. In fact, she seems to be in control the majority of the case by limiting dad's parenting time, controlling his parenting time, and by ultimately the court deciding joint legal custody. So no power, no evidence of the power, the coerciveness, I guess you'd say, interfering with either parent's power.
Ms. Bornman.
Go ahead, Judge Smith. As far as the expert witnesses, the trial court made other findings as to why the expert shouldn't be allowed to testify. It wasn't just correct?
That is the argument that opposing counsel makes. And yes, the court said things that are not accurate. Of course, we would dispute because the court said specifically, I believe, that his information would be unhelpful in determining custody and parenting time. Well, right off the bat, I gave you information about how that expert could have talked about this pattern of lying by mother to get all these allegations against father to stick, or trying to get them to stick originally, would indicate a pattern that she's going to continue lying and that she's going to continue trying to interfere with his relationship with the children. Again, that 11th best interest factor that the court decided to ignore in this case.
Counsel, could you just clarify for me precisely what Dr. Barden reviewed in preparing the report? I think it's not exactly clear to me from reading the briefs exactly what was reviewed.
Understood. And respondent did say that he hadn't reviewed mother's medical record or therapy records, but that was incorrect. So he had reviewed the therapy records because those came to light when mother included them as exhibits prior to trial. So he'd reviewed those. He'd reviewed father's medical, it's under the guise of medical, but therapy records. He had reviewed the information regarding Ms. Burns, the therapist who had previously written a letter, which, by the way, the court relied on that unreliable therapist who, with minimal qualifications, when that therapist wrote a letter, Ms. Burns, saying that the nonverbal children, that she believed that they were indicating sexual abuse when she'd only spoken to mother, the court relied on that letter and limited my client's parenting time. It was cut off 100% for months until he was able to undo that through the guardian ad litem and supervised parenting time. So the court at one point relied on an expert with essentially no qualifications because, of course, Dr. Barden, you know, rips her to shreds in one of his early reports, but then declined to even read the report of Dr. Barden with his credentials and consider that. So the arguments that he had not spoken to mother didn't apply when therapist Burns hadn't spoken to father, but now they apply. And also an expert witness can give opinions and science and whatnot without actually talking to the individuals involved in the case. And that happens all the time, of course, because sometimes their information is going to be generic, and then the court is supposed to take that information and apply the facts of the actual case to reach her conclusion. Because, of course, the expert's not there to give the referee the conclusion. He's there to give the science to aid her.
And what are the precise issues that you think the expert's testimony would have aided the court? Because, I mean, we're stuck with a district court order that said, I don't think this would have been helpful. So what are the precise issues where you think it would have aided the court?
Understood. So, of course, we've talked about credibility, right? The pattern of the fact that she made these allegations for as many as year, I mean, maybe 2-3 years, I can't remember honestly at this point, but made the allegation for years, which shows a pattern of attempting to interfere with his relationship with the children, and shows lying. And so his testimony, of course, would have been someone with mental conditions that would allow them to do such a thing is likely to continue without serious interventions. We were asking this court to put interventions in place that would get mom to change her behavior. We wanted mom to have to do intensive therapy, not the therapy that she had with the therapist who essentially gave her a clean bill of health saying it's not medically necessary for her to have therapy, but yes, she could benefit. And then, of course, mom took that as, okay, I don't have to go. And the guardian was okay with that. And so we wanted serious interventions that would really make her delve into the issues of interfering with dad's time. That expert could have gone into that. He also talked about memory contamination. The order for protection in this case has one bit of allegations. By the time we get at trial, the story has grown 100 times. And the therapist along the way, Dr. Barden had a conclusion that the therapist along the way made mother believe that she was a victim of domestic abuse and contaminated her memory and her belief about this situation. And I realize I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce your client and yourself, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Case, and I'm here on behalf of my client, the respondent, Hortensia Salcedo Abad. Your Honors, this court should affirm the district court's decision for three main reasons. Number one, Dr. Barden was properly excluded on the basis of untimeliness in terms of disclosure, and also on the grounds of the fact that his testimony would not be helpful to the district court. Second, the district court correctly applied the domestic abuse standard as set forth in the relevant statutes and determined that first, appellant committed domestic abuse against the respondent, and then second, expanded upon that ruling by clarifying the nature and context of his behavior as being coercive control, which encompasses the acts of domestic abuse. Third, the district court, based on its correct finding of domestic abuse based on extensive testimony, properly determined that the 11th best interest factor was not applicable as stated in the relevant statute. And in declining to consider the 11th best interest factor, I would also note for the court, and I believe it's well detailed in our brief, that the district court implicitly addressed the 11th best interest factor by overlapping issues that are raised by the other best interest factors, especially the ones that are relevant to the relationship between the parents and the relationship with the children. So on those three issues, the district court's order should be affirmed. Starting with the exclusion of Dr. Barden, I think it's well documented in terms of the timeliness issue why that issue should be affirmed. And I just want to raise one piece on that with regard to counsel's argument that for general practice rule 14 is a grounds for reversal. As detailed in our brief, it's our position that appellant essentially forfeited that issue because under the rule, I believe it's rule 1401C of the Minnesota Rules of General Practice, that rule specifically requires that a motion be made in order to receive relief when there's a technical error with the Minnesota Odyssey e-filing and e-service system. No motion was ever brought. The district...
Counsel, I guess my question is maybe a step before we get to the Rule 14 question, and that is, what authority do you have that the district court could ignore the factors set forth in Denny when deciding whether or not to exclude this expert?
That's a good question, Your Honor. So the reason that Denny doesn't govern this issue is because Denny is distinguishable entirely because it's a medical malpractice case in which the experts at issue there were excluded on the grounds of untimeliness, and so the Minnesota Supreme Court fashioned a test, and that test can apply when there's untimely disclosure of experts. The distinguishing factor about that case, though, Your Honor, is the fact that in a medical malpractice case, unlike a custody dispute like we have here, in a medical malpractice case, medical expert testimony is dispositive of the entire case. And so if a medical expert is precluded from testifying, the plaintiff essentially loses their right to move forward with their case entirely. It is dispositive.
Do you have any cases to support the idea that Denny only applies when the expert is dispositive of the issue? Have we or the Minnesota Supreme Court ever applied Denny in that manner? Because certainly Denny has been said that you only need to review the relevant factors and that you need to... You know, you don't, if the factors aren't relevant to the particular type of case that you have, you don't need to review all of them. But I don't know that we have a case that says only when the expert affidavit is dispositive do you have to consider the Denny factors.
If my memory serves me, Your Honor, and this is in our brief, there are at least a few cases in which this court has discussed Denny's application and has distinguished it on that grounds, on the fact that in cases where there's, you know, maybe a supporting expert that has some, you know, potentially helpful testimony to the proponent's case, that is distinguishable from a situation which the entire case falls or prevails based on that expert's testimony. There's a few cases that I know I included in our brief that addresses that distinguishing aspect. So I would rely on our brief for that part.
My other question with regard to this is, what prejudice was there to your client in terms of not receiving the expert notice? And I ask it in the context of you had received initial reports from this precise expert. The timing that was missed was identifying an expert of which your client already had the expert report, and then I believe the expert report was disclosed on the date that was set forth in the scheduling order. And so it's not clear to me what the prejudice was to your client when it was pretty clear that they had been relying on this expert throughout this litigation.
Understood, Your Honor. So as the district court noted in its order, the fact that a report has been offered for one purpose throughout the entirety of an extended proceeding like this doesn't necessarily inform opposing counsel that that report and that witness is going to be used for a particular purpose at trial. So while that expert report was submitted in regards to, I believe it was a motion in 2018 regarding some modification of parenting time, the fact that it had been offered, you know, is almost 2 years prior does not necessarily inform the purpose or intent of why it would be offered at trial. Secondly, although it was being offered at the time of trial, I believe your question was, what was the prejudice of that delayed notice? Well, I think that's actually evident in the transcript. I believe it's pages 92 to 95, approximately. In the transcript, it's made clear that I believe it was during a break, counsel had indicated that Dr. Barton had just reviewed some additional records disclosed as exhibits and then now was amending his proposed testimony to be addressing alteration of mother's memories by her therapist. That opinion had never been previously disclosed, and as the district court highlighted in its written order, The lack of notice was prejudicial to my client because the lack of notice on those particular issues deprived her of the opportunity to get a rebuttal expert witness if he was going to be able to testify. And in order to rebut opinions about altering memories by her therapist such that she lacks credibility to testify about instances of domestic abuse is something that my client was should be entitled to have time to adequately prepare for.
But if that wasn't within the scope of the report that was timely submitted, then there would have been a separate reason to exclude something like that, correct?
Sorry, could you repeat the question, Your Honor?
You don't disagree that they filed the expert report on time.
As indicated in
under the scheduling order,
there was service on that date. We don't dispute that necessarily, but as indicated in the district court record, the district court determined that it was not timely served, and that essentially, although there might have been a technical error at that time, notice was ultimately not provided on time.
I guess this goes to my question of prejudice, because I do think that there was a degree to which your client could have minimized the attorneys could have minimized the prejudice to your client by advising appellant's counsel that this file was corrupted. And I do think, as a general matter of professional decorum, that would be the appropriate thing to do from a professional decorum standpoint. And so when we're weighing what prejudice there is to your client, how are we supposed to look at the fact that this really, appears to have been a technical odyssey error that could have been resolved by the parties without the intervention of the court?
Understood, Your Honor. And while the prejudice could have been mitigated in certain ways, the availability of an alternative remedy in and of itself does not demonstrate reversible error. I would also point to the section of our brief that discusses that even if it was erroneous to preclude Dr. Barton on the grounds of timeliness, the district court also found that his testimony would not be helpful. And ultimately, with that ground of exclusion in mind, the exclusion of Dr. Barton would ultimately be a harmless error because essentially the admission of his testimony wouldn't have changed the result of the trial.
And why would the proposed expert testimony be unhelpful? I guess I can't remember whether the district court gave particular reasons, and if the judge didn't, are there other reasons apparent in the record as to why it would be unhelpful?
So the district court indicates in its order that the reason it would not be helpful is largely because Dr. Barton was not familiar enough with the facts of the case. He had never met mother. He had never met the children. He had never met mother's mental health records until, at least for the first time that it's appearing in the record, on the day of trial, it was mentioned that he had reviewed the records, at that point in time, which prompted a change in his opinion. But in terms of why it was unhelpful, Your Honor, it would be unhelpful because it doesn't really go towards the best interest factors. If anything, his testimony was focused on credibility, but essentially those are matters that the district court is more than well equipped to address. Plus, Dr. Barton's proposed testimony was about the alteration of children's memories as it relates to the unsubstantiated allegations of sexual abuse. The district court was well aware of those allegations, addressed them in a pretrial motion several months leading up to trial, and had full understanding of what Dr. Barton's proposed testimony was, as shown by approximately, the first 100 pages of the transcript is on and off argument about whether or not his testimony should be admitted. The district court had full understanding of what, his proposed testimony was. And as to the alteration of children's memories, my client had withdrawn the allegations of sexual abuse by the time trial started. And so essentially that issue was not a trial issue anymore. It was a moot issue. And on top of that, the fact that Dr. Barton wanted to opine on essentially credibility of the guardian ad litem or things like that, those were not opinions that were noticed in advance as well.
I'd like to ask, I'm switching issues now.
Yep.
To the second issue. So what, in your view, is the factual basis or bases of the finding of domestic abuse?
So, Your Honor, there was 8 pages of single-spaced analysis by the district court on the fourth best interest factor. And I'd also like to point out that the fourth best interest factor, as noted in the statute, not only does it require the district court to consider whether there were instances of domestic abuse, but it specifically also requires the district court to consider the nature and context in which the domestic abuse occurred. And so in doing so, the district court spent 8 pages of analysis based on, I believe there was a total of, including father and mother, 7 witnesses in total that testified on, at least peripherally, on the issues of domestic abuse. There was a restaurant employee. There was a employee from a remodeling store. There was two neighbors. And there was a my client's mother who also testified. Now,
and so can you pinpoint what did he do that was domestic abuse?
So, for example, just the July 16th, 2016 instance alone, physically picking somebody up, restraining them, sitting on their chest, restraining them from leaving the apartment, and essentially chasing her out into the backyard that was witnessed by another individual, you know, that physical restraint, preventing her from leaving, that's physical contact. And on another occasion...
So the statute requires at least 1 of 3 requirements as physical harm, bodily injury, or assault.
Correct. And assault, as this court is well aware, falls into 2 categories, assault harm or assault fear. So for assault fear, the victim has to be in reasonable fear of imminent physical harm. There are numerous occasions in which it is well documented from the testimony of not only my client, but several other witnesses that she was in fear of physical harm. There was an instance in which she locked herself in the car because she was afraid of physical harm from the appellant. There was an instance in which the appellant grabbed her breast and caused pain when picking her up and restraining her in the kitchen.
I should say the second requirement of the statute is the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault.
But correct.
Those two.
And so not only are there instances of actual physical harm, especially the July 16th, 2016 instance and the prior instance in which he caused harm by grabbing her breast, there was also instances in which she was in reasonable fear of imminent harm. It was well documented about a number of rageful outbursts from several witnesses. And, it was well documented essentially how she had trouble trying to leave the apartment when he would restrain her. And it's well documented not only in our brief, but in the trial transcript. And the district court devoted, over 8 pages of single space analysis to this. And on top of that, I just would like to, I know I'm running out of time, but on the issue of coercive control, I would rely on our brief and point to the fact that the district court could not have been more explicit about the fact that it found domestic abuse first, and then it clarified the nature of nature and context of that abuse was, in fact, coercive control. And so the domestic abuse was encompassed within the coercive control. It didn't conflate the two standards.
And is that finding of coercive control, is that essential to the finding of domestic abuse?
I don't believe it's essential, Your Honor, but it was the district court doing its duty to discuss the nature and context of the domestic abuse. I would also like to highlight that later in the order, the district court actually discusses domestic abuse and coercive control as distinct concepts. It says that not only has mother suffered instances of coercive control, but also incidences of domestic abuse. So with that in mind, I think that is demonstrative of the fact that the district court understood that those were 2 separate concepts and did not conflate them, but actually properly analyzed them in describing the nature and context in which the abuse occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Case.
Thank you.
Ms. Bornman-Spears, you have 5 minutes allocated for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to quickly address some of the domestic abuse pieces or answers that you were given just now. For example, the restaurant individual who testified, he described mother as sheepish and that father was apparently yelling, which is still less than what Thornton and Vasquez direct as far as the behavior of that individual before he was found to have been coercively controlling. The remodeling store, mother wasn't even there. Actually, father was there defending mother because she told him that the people at the remodeling store mistreated her. Mother, as in grandmother of the children, or mother of the mother in this case, did not say that my client had domestically abused his daughter. And nobody said that she was picked up and spun around. I mean, she literally described a motion of that my client did this to her in the courtroom. And yes, the court wrote 8 pages single space because the mother was allowed to literally testify for days regarding these allegations, which again, I will remind you, was astronomically greater than anything that had ever been indicated before, despite her having an order for protection filed, extended multiple times, plus a custody evaluator audience, a guardian audience, a therapist audience. No one had ever heard any of this until she was given the pleasure of testifying for days, which unfortunately I have to say was a pleasure for her.
Here at the district court made findings that the respondent felt enormous pain and caused terrible fear. That was a finding. The court characterized the day in 2016 as the last incident of domestic abuse. And the district court also found the mother's testimony and that of the witnesses on this issue to be more credible than the father's. How do we overcome that?
Well, that gets us back to our expert, right? The expert would have likely diminished or pointed out, given reason to diminish the credibility.
About the court, district court's finding. How
okay.
do we overcome that without the expert testimony? Do you
Understood.
Agree that that's binding on us?
I agree that the court's findings of credibility are binding, but I believe that we get back a step further than that, that she should have allowed the expert who may have affected her determinations of credibility, as well as the guardian's determinations of credibility and the guardian's ultimate recommendations.
Without the expert, we're bound by the district court's finding. Would you agree with that?
Yes, we have lots of case law that tells us that
okay.
That we have to rely on that. But again, what the worst findings of the court that the fear, I mean, fear of what it says of bodily harm. I mean, Your Honor just brought up the fact that assault is more descriptive than what we have in our ultimate result of this trial court. I also want to bring up that the grabbed her breast incident was a completely different account of that situation by my client, which again, we go back to credibility that, and during the July 16th incident, everyone described him as calm and he described himself as being afraid that day. And nobody said that her fear was because of his actions. They just described her as appearing fearful, but didn't. That cause is left out, which is crucial. I also want to respond to the fact that Respondent's Counsel just said that it was a moot issue, that mother had previously made all the accusations she made against father about abuse against the children. Because that wasn't moot. That's a big part of our argument. That issue is not moot because of factor 11. The court should have considered her efforts to interfere with his relationship. I also want to point out that notice of the expert was separate from the report. I think the court was exactly on track this morning asking about that. Our report was served on time. Furthermore, Dr. Barden was present at all the different hearings, so there was an ongoing presence there that made the other side aware that he was ongoing involved in the case. And the therapy records that he reviewed right before trial had been kept a secret despite the custody evaluator trying to get a hold of those therapy records. So, and also an expert has every right throughout the process of a trial to listen to testimony and ultimately amend their findings as more evidence comes to light. It's essentially their job. I would also point out that the custody evaluator, everyone relied on his report. It came in, his testimony came in. He referenced Dr. Barden's report, which he actually read. I want to remind everyone that the referee said she never read his report. So she made these findings and these allegations that it would be unhelpful and irrelevant without voir dire of the witness and without ever reading his reports. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borman-Spears. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments, both written and oral. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.